Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The average private college student pays about 130% more in tuition than their parents back in the day. For students at public four-year institutions, we're talking about a more than 200% increase. The sticker shock is necessarily affecting decisions about pursuing higher education. Some public and private institutions are starting to respond with new calculations and, in some cases, price matching with competing institutions. Coming up, the president of an Atlanta-based private college talks about their price matching program, and OSU officials come on to talk about a recent reduction in fees. Inside Higher Ed business and management reporter Rick Seltzer has been covering the issue. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What do we know in general about how tuition has been figured traditionally?
So a lot goes into setting tuition and fees. If you're a college or university, you have a number of different sources of revenue. You have the amount students pay, that's tuition fees. You have money you can draw from an endowment, money donors give, grant money for research, state grants and federal grants, and then also money that state and local governments provide to help you run your operations if you are a public university. The basic idea is you need to draw enough revenue from all of those sources to be able to offset the cost of running the university, keeping the doors open, paying the professors, that kind of thing.
And so do they take this big pile of money, let's say it's $100, and they split it up between all the students that are going to be on campus that year, and that's what the tuition is?
If only it was that easy. There are a number of different actual budgeting models that are going on, depending on the college or university. But generally what you're seeing in the last decade or so is some changes in who is paying and who can pay. So on the public university side, states and local governments generally are paying less or keeping the amount that they pay flat. And so you're seeing increasing amounts of pressure put on tuition. At the same time, different groups of students are having different amounts of money that they can pay. We hear a lot about income inequality. Mm-hmm. Basically, that means that richer students have more free cash flow, whereas your middle-class students typically are not seeing the amount that they can pay to go to college go up. At the same time, you have colleges, an enrollment cycle that starts a couple years before the student actually goes. And colleges, in many cases, they're not completely shooting in the dark to figure out how many students they're going to enroll, mm-hmm. but they don't have as much visibility as they probably would like to have in many cases. So it's kind of I don't want to call it a guessing game because there is some very sophisticated modeling that goes into this, but it can be hard to say, here's exactly how many students we have and here's how much each one is going to pay, because there's a concept called tuition discounting. And that basically means the sticker price that you see, that posted tuition price that a college or university puts up, many students don't actually pay that. They pay far less. And so you have a number of different variables that make it hard to figure exactly how much tuition dollars we're going to collect.
Is the sticker price versus the actual price more different for private institutions than it is for public?
Generally, it is, yes. And generally, what's happening is for private universities, the sticker price has been diverging from the actual net price that students pay pretty quickly over the last decade. In 2006, 2007, the tuition discount rate was 35.1%. It's up to 44.8% in 2017-18, according to the latest data. That basically means for every dollar of tuition a private nonprofit college charges in the country, on average, it's actually pocketing about 45 cents less than that sticker price would make it look like it's pocketing. This is nothing new, mm-hmm. but there's been a pretty rapid rate of increase in the last 10 years that's caused a lot of hand-wringing.
And it's important to distinguish private nonprofit from private for-profit.
That's correct. Yeah, the for-profit side works. They use some of the same marketing techniques, but the business model is pretty considerably different. I would also distinguish private nonprofit from public institutions, mm-hmm. although again, they discount in many cases as well. So basically, though, what you have happening as this tuition discounting practice has increased, you have a lot of fear that families don't like these high sticker prices, that they're scared off by them in mm-hmm. some cases. And some college leaders worry that a family who is middle class or poor basically takes a look at a high sticker price, says, oh, I can never pay that, and then either chooses to enroll in a cheaper university, a public university, mm-hmm. if you're a private that's competing with publics, or in some cases, the fear is they take a look at it and say, you know what, I just can't pay to go to college. I'm not even going to apply.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the calculus of tuition and fees in colleges and higher education today and how it's changed over time. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest right now is Rick Seltzer. He's a business and management reporter for Inside Higher Ed. Coming up, we're going to hear from Ohio State University officials. We're going to hear from an Ohio Wesleyan University official and also from the president of a private nonprofit in Georgia that is doing something called price matching, which we'll be talking about at length today. What's the biggest culprit behind those increases I mentioned at the top, roughly 130% increase in private nonprofit institutions in the cost of education and an over 200% increase in public nonprofit?
There's a lot of disagreement about what the culprits are. I generally think there are a number of different things that you have to take into account when you're talking about this. Many people, particularly on the public side, will say it is the fact that state governments are not funding public universities at the rates that they traditionally have.
Starting about 20 years ago, they started to cut precipitously.
It has been over a period of decades. Mm-hmm. A number of people will tell you that it really accelerated after the Great Recession,
right?
And after the pressure that was put on state budgets. So I think there's pressure there. I do think that income inequality is part of it, because that has forced people to turn to, particularly on the private side, it has forced people to turn to this practice of tuition discounting. But the way tuition discounting works is you have a handful of wealthy students who pay full price. Ideally, many colleges have gotten to the point where you don't really have that many. But you have this core number of students who pay the full sticker price, who are giving you a good amount of net revenue per student. And then most other people who are attending pay far, far less. As income inequality grows, if we accept that it's growing, you're going to basically keep having to raise the sticker price more and more to keep drawing more revenue from that small group of students who's paying full price. So you kind of have an accelerating effect there to the point where people wonder, well, wait, when does that get tapped out? When can we actually not draw more from these students? And then you get into the question of why educational costs are rising. Why do colleges keep having to raise prices?
Right.
That's a whole other discussion. There are several theories. One is that, like most institutions, colleges will maximize their revenue.
Get as much as they can.
They'll collect as much as they can because these are institutions that are under a lot of demand. There are a lot of demands for many services from them, whether that be services to help students who maybe need counseling or maybe need remediation, or to provide amenities to wealthy students who say, I'm paying all of this money, why can't I have a nicer dormitory or what have you? And then there are demands for research. If you want to do good top research, you need facilities. You need to pay professors well, although many professors will tell you they're not paid particularly well. So there are just a lot of demands that force colleges to want to collect as much money as possible. At the same time, I think you talk to most administrators, they'll tell you, we try very hard to keep costs down. There are some structural things, either in the economy or within our institution, that make that very hard. So you've got just this giant whirlwind where it's hard for places to rein in the amount of money that they need.
A lot of the price reductions that are used by colleges and universities, public and private, are associated with academics and academic success, right?
Yes, I think that's fair to say.
So in the case of price matching, first, let's define what price matching is as we move forward.
Sure. So I think to understand price matching, it's important to talk about the concept of a tuition reset first.
Okay.
Which is basically, so we have this high sticker price, high discount model that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And in a tuition reset, basically you have people saying, wait, this has gotten out of hand. We're scaring off too many students. We're just going to slash that sticker price. And we're going to also cut the amount that we are offering in financial aid.
Hmm.
And more or less what that does is the amount that students, your average student actually pays does not change, but the sticker price ends up being much lower. So hence the idea of resetting the price.
Okay.
So that's a tuition reset. You've seen that get a lot of traction in recent years, although again, that's not necessarily a new idea. Places have tried it for a decade or more at least. So I think of a flagship match as almost a halfway step toward a tuition reset. Although it's a really interesting kind of marketing strategy combined with it, too. And basically, in a flagship match, you'll have a private nonprofit university say, you high-achieving student can attend our campus for the same price it would cost to attend a public flagship university. Because the public flagship university will have a lower sticker price. It advertises a lower price.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes that price is in the ballpark of what the private university is actually collecting from students after all of that discounting is done. So I think of a flagship match as kind of a resetting tuition for a certain group of students. And then using this big name of a flagship university to gain attention for the pricing model.
It's a marketing scheme. They probably would reduce the tuition anyway for a high-achieving student.
Right, but the question is, can you get that high-achieving student to apply in the first place or
mm-hmm.
to realistically consider attending or realistically look at what price they're going to pay?
And that's what I mean by a marketing scheme. It's a way to get them to pay attention and look into this.
Marketing is a big part of these moves. Marketing is a big part of all of these pricing moves. I think there's an interesting new development right now going on with this. And that's kind of using a tuition reset model plus using it to really fundraise. We actually just saw St. John's College, which is a great books college that has two campuses, one in Annapolis in Maryland and one in Santa Fe in New Mexico. They just announced a tuition reset that will go into place next year. They're cutting the sticker price by about 33%, but they're saying they're not necessarily going to cut student aid by an equivalent amount. Instead, they're going to try to raise more money from their donors to offset that change. Now, again, there's still an element of marketing to that, right? Because, well, why wouldn't you just raise the money from the donors in the first place? But donors care about marketing, too, it turns out. Just as it gets attention from students, you can use this kind of a move to get attention from donors.
And going back quickly, you know, the buildings and the fancier dorms and all that kind of junk, the universities typically will tell you, well, that's coming from our capital budget. That's not coming from what tuition pays for. That's a whole different pile of money. But is it because you have to operate those buildings? You have to heat them. You have to, staff them.
Well, like every answer I've given you, the answer is it depends or
yeah.
it's complicated.
Yeah.
you're right, though. There are operating costs associated with buildings. At some level, you need to raise the money for the building. Now, oftentimes in the modern university, they are raising money from donors to put the capital forward to build the building, or they are issuing debt. They're going into debt to do it. Or in some cases, they're actually doing deals with private developers, which is very interesting. But in all of those cases, except for probably the donor case, whether you're going in with a private developer or issuing bonds to pay for a facility, you have to pay that money back over time with interest. And even in the case of a donor who gives money to get the walls up, you're right. You have to hire staff who are going to staff that building, and you have to pay to heat it. You have to pay for water. You have to pay for all of those things that are associated with operating the building. So the budgets do kind of feed each other in some ways, yes.
Well, Rick Seltzer, thanks for getting us started in this conversation today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Rick Seltzer is the Inside Higher Ed business and management reporter. We're going to continue our conversation about What goes into setting tuition levels, fee levels, and how colleges and universities figure out how to reset or decrease or eliminate, in some cases, as in Ohio State's recent announcement, fees altogether. So stay with us. And if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Private colleges and universities, I should say private nonprofit colleges and universities, are changing the metrics for tuition, in some cases lowering the rate to compete with public institutions. This is part of a larger trend to address the sticker shock many students and their parents are experiencing in deciding on higher education. Ohio State recently announced plans to eliminate some 70% of course fees, among other things. The reduction is part of a collaboration between student government and the administration. So joining us is OSU Student Government President Shamina Merchant. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
And OSU Interim Senior Vice President, Chief Financial Officer, and Treasurer with not a lot of jobs to do, Michael Papadakis. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
And by phone from Delaware County, Ohio Wesleyan University Vice President for Enrollment and Communications, Stephanie Niles. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Thank you. Good morning.
Stephanie, how does Ohio Wesleyan figure tuition as a private nonprofit?
Sure. Well, there's a number of factors that are considered when we're looking at tuition. Of course, we need to look at what are the revenues necessary to sustain our operating budget based on the number of students that we anticipate enrolling and the capacity that we have to serve those students. And then, of course, we also have to determine that in light of recruitment trends and our ability, market trends, and our ability to secure those numbers of students and the corresponding dollars that they will bring with them. So it's really a joint effort amongst a number of offices and operations on campus to understand who are the students, who are their families, what's the market like, and what are they going to be willing to pay for the educational experience that we're offering. What are indeed we offering them based on the revenue that we're generating, and what is it that we need to sustain our overall cost?
We have been talking about price matching. We'll be talking with the president of Atlanta-based Oglethorpe University in a few minutes. And there they are offering a program that in which qualified students pay the same amount as the flagship public universities in their home states. I'm sure you've heard about this. What are your calculations in going in that direction or not?
I have heard about that. I actually have been at Ohio Wesleyan for just about a month, and mm-hmm. so that has been a very brief conversation that we've had in light of some of the institutions that have made these recent announcements. Mm-hmm. It's certainly something that we need to pay close attention to as it is impacting the market, as expectations of families. We need to understand, as I said earlier, what that market expects. And so it's something that I think would say at this point we're keeping a close eye on. As I think what the gentleman who spoke earlier, Rick, stated, there have been for many, many years institutions that have done a price reduction. This is a bit of a newer trend, and I use the word trend loosely.
This is like a tuition reset, he mentioned.
Exactly. Yeah. Right, right. But the idea of price matching, like Oglethorpe is going to be doing, is a little bit of a newer slant. And so I think it'll be intriguing to watch how families respond to that. I think one question is, if you are price matching with a public institution, is the expectation the same as, will families perceive that what you're getting is the equivalent of a public institution? And so will they perceive a difference in quality of the experience? That being said, families have real tough decisions to make about how to utilize their funds, their family dollars, mm-hmm. and how to invest in the educational experience. And so how many families are not just willing but are able to pay the higher priced cost. So it's an intriguing idea and one that bears close watching over the course of the next year.
At Ohio Wesleyan, what is the sticker price for tuition?
We are right about our total cost is right about $60,000. That's an all-in cost, mm-hmm. tuition, room, board, and fees.
And how many, what percentage of the students at Ohio Wesleyan this year actually pay that?
Not many. About 97% of our students are receiving aid, both need-based and or merit-based aid. So it is definitely, you know, we are indeed, you could say, reducing the price for many students based on their ability to secure need-based institutional funds. Some of them, of course, are bringing federal and state aid to the table, mm-hmm. and students are also receiving institutional funds that are dedicated for this purpose.
And from what you understand about the market, is that pretty typical in
it
private
is.
Nonprofit?
It is.
Yeah. Okay.
It is. It's very typical to offer certainly need-based aid, and many institutions also offer merit-based aid
yeah.
to students as well.
Michael Papadakis, how is tuition calculated at Ohio State? I know it's it's complicated and it depends.
So I think there are a number of factors that go into it, obviously. I think ultimately we look at the total cost to educate students and we think about what portion of that funding is going to come from the state. And so we do get a portion of our funding from the state of Ohio. And so ultimately we look at what portion is going to come from the state, what the total cost is, and then we sort of figure out exactly where we think tuition should be.
When the university decides to freeze tuition rates for any number of years, mm-hmm. how do you know that you can do that, or out of whose hide does that come?
For us, it's really part of a broader initiative to keep costs down for students. And so we're thinking about not necessarily that it comes out of someone's hide. We're ultimately thinking about how do we cut costs overall at the institution so that everyone can still have the same amount of dollars to actually do the educational process. So for us, it's really about finding efficiencies that we can then use to keep tuition flat, hopefully over time.
And Ohio State is Ohio's biggest institution, biggest public nonprofit
right.
institution. What can you give me a little thumbnail on the decrease in state support for Ohio State in the past several decades?
If you think about us in kind of the mid-1980s, late 1980s, we used to get between 30 and 35% of our funding of the total budget from the state. Today, it's about 7%. Part of that is a fact that our medical center has grown dramatically, so it's a smaller piece of the total budget, but it's still...
Because it doesn't fund the medical
correct.
Center.
That's yeah. correct.
The fee cut... Well, explain the timing of the announcement to lower or nix some fees in some cases at Ohio State. That starts next year, or did it start this year?
So it'll start in the spring of 2019,
okay.
so spring semester of 2019,
okay.
so essentially this academic year. And it was really about something we've been working on for the last couple of years. We've been working with the student government folks and some folks on our faculty as well to sort of figure out what made sense from a fee perspective, and ultimately landed on this as a proposal.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what goes into determining the cost of tuition at our public and private nonprofit institutions. You just heard from Michael Papadakis. He is the interim CFO, among other things, treasurer, and also senior vice president at Ohio State. He's the interim senior vice president at Ohio State. Also with us is Stephanie Niles. She's vice president for enrollment and communications at Ohio Wesleyan University in Delaware County. And also with us, Shamina Merchant. She's the OSU student government president. So, Shamina, the fee cuts are a result of a collaboration between student government and the administration. It's expected to save thousands of students a total of $2 million. How is student government involved in this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as students, we're very aware of the total cost of attendance and wanted to make sure that we were recognizing this tuition guarantee that Ohio State is a part of as an opportunity to make sure that students truly understood how much education would cost them. And so from student government perspective, we've spoken to students who didn't anticipate some of these course fees earlier
on. Give
me an
example of what you mean.
Yeah. So a student actually had a $300 fee that they didn't know they'd have to pay for. And because of that, wasn't able to come up with the funds in a reasonable amount of time. Unfortunately, that student wasn't aware of some of the opportunities Ohio State has in place to provide support in those types of situations. But because of that, they were dropped from their classes and kind of struggled to get their feet back together. Mm-hmm. And so we saw this as a way to make sure that we were increasing transparency on the student end and being clear about what the total cost of attendance and tuition really was, and also making sure that we could prevent situations like that in the future. It's a consistent focus for Ohio State to provide the most affordable education possible while also making sure that that quality of education remains as high as possible.
So how were you able to reduce or cut fees, Michael Papadakis?
So back to what I said earlier, it was really about having efficiencies at the university such that we could cut fees but still have the units.
Can you give me an example of what you mean?
So we have, over the course of the last 5 years, put in place a variety of efficiency initiatives. We're at the point where we're saving roughly $50 million a year from the university operating budget from a variety of sources. For instance, we have mandated much more central procurement of supplies and have gone out and actually negotiated much more beneficial terms. So we've saving significant amounts of money there. We're also looking at all the different support units across the university and making sure that they're staffed at the appropriate levels to make sure that they're providing the services that we need, but maybe not overstaffed to the level they may have been in the past as well.
You're listening to All Sides with Ian Fisher. We're talking about what it costs to go to college today. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. And Sarah in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question about some of the creative thinking you guys mentioned around fee models. Specifically, are there programs out there that have considered formatting the classes, course load, credit hours, and fees so that students can work their way through their education? And I'm happy to take your answer offline.
You mean like in the olden days?
Yes.
Okay. It's actually something that someone could pay for and not have to go in debt or rob a bank or soak somebody somewhere along the line for. Stephanie Niles, thoughts about that?
Well, of course, it's a little different at a place like Ohio Wesleyan. At a private nonprofit, we charge we don't charge a per course fee in quite the same way. The vast majority of our students are enrolled as full time students. There are a handful of part time students, and this is relatively consistent with institutions of our type. So, in our case, they would be paying for the full immersive experience of being a full time student mm-hmm. on that campus. So, the idea of fees per se for classes doesn't really apply in the same way.
I wouldn't want to trade my time in college and that whole immersive experience for anything, but the way colleges are set up, it's hard for somebody to really go part-time. Michael Papadakis, have you thought about that? I mean, I suppose the online is one way of doing it.
So so on the Columbus campus, most of our students are full-time. We do have students that tend to start at our regional campuses who might be more on a part-time basis mm-hmm. or who may ultimately want to transfer to Columbus after a couple of years. So we do have students who ultimately do take the part-time path. But for the vast majority of Columbus students are here full-time. We do have some in certain professional programs, like we have a part-time MBA program, which is a sort of after-work type of program, mm-hmm. things like that. But for the most part, in Columbus, most of our students are full-time.
Have there been discussions about changing that paradigm?
Not really changing that paradigm.
As you're building more and more dorms, I should
add. Yeah, we've had lots of conversations about, again, making it as affordable as we can for students. So our sticker price for in-state students is between $10,000 and $10,700 for tuition. We actually had a five-year tuition freeze for in-state students from 2012 to 2017 and then have now participated in the tuition guarantee the last 2 years. So you come in as a freshman, you get a small increase as a freshman, and you're locked in at that rate for your next 4 years.
Shamina Merchant, what about that? What about non-traditional students? Do they have a voice in student government, and are they relevant?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, this has been a priority this past year to make sure that we were doing a better job to listen to the unique situations of students that may not fall under the same traditional experience that myself or some of my peers might have had. One of the things that we're doing in particular, and actually working with Mike and other stakeholders at the university, is trying to be as transparent about a student's entire financial journey. And so working to create a universal scholarship database that a student could put in the particulars of their situation, including if they were at a regional campus, if they were part-time, anything that qualifies them to be a non-traditional student, and be able to see all of the opportunities available for them to make sure that their education is as affordable as possible and that they're getting all of the scholarships.
And that database, that exists now, or you're working on it?
That's what we're working to create, and it's actually been a major project that the university has devoted to putting key stakeholders at the table to making this possible.
And what about the differences between the cost of education for, say, a history major and somebody who wants to study physics, Stephanie Niles? How do you figure that? Do the English majors help pay for the physics majors?
Yeah, I mean, our students, of course, are paying a flat fee. And so, you know, all students are benefiting from high-quality instruction from a very dedicated faculty. They're all paying for and receiving the benefit of high-quality classroom experiences, both in terms of the physical experience as well as the challenge of the students around them. You know, they whether they're paying, you know, whether they're in a lab or they're in a classroom, again, it's truly, you know, many institutional costs go towards paying for high-quality instructors. And so, of course, we want to be competitive with salaries and benefits as we attract those top-notch professors. That's really what's going to make a difference in the lives and the experiences of our students as they take the knowledge from whatever their major may be out into the wider world.
And at Ohio State, Michael Papadakis?
So a little bit different at OSU. So we do have lab fees for certain courses, typically physics, biology, chemistry are the most typical. And those fees are being kept in place because there is an additional cost to actually teach those lab courses. So we really just cover the cost of operating the lab, essentially.
Okay. And, you know, as we move more forward into this more STEM-oriented world of education, it must be getting really expensive. How do you manage that?
Again, for us, it's really looking at the total cost to educate, deciding exactly how much we think we're going to get from the state, and then essentially filling that hole, whether it's through tuition or through an actual lab fee. And so ultimately, we will take a look at that going forward, but it's unlikely that lab fees will go away in the near term, as those are mm-hmm. things that are additional costs that we have to bear ultimately to educate students the way we want to.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephanie Niles, one more question for you is how far – I know you've just been there a month, but I mean typically how far in advance are you calculating what will be charged students in the coming years?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, that's a timely question because we're doing that right now.
Okay.
The hope is that at our October board meeting, which is in just a few weeks, that the Board of Trustees will approve tuition, room, and board for next year. So we are trying to set that far in advance to give families enough time, both our returning students and those whom we're now recruiting, enough time to plan for a potential increase if one is realized.
And Michael Papadakis, one more question for you. Private universities have more traditionally have had endowments in place. Mm-hmm. You know, we hear about Harvard and Yale and that kind
sure.
of a thing. Ohio State has similarly started to just raise money, a large endowment fund for the university.
We do. We have a $5.2 billion total endowment fund, which funds things like scholarships, faculty hiring, research initiatives, things of that nature. If you look at us, though, on a per-student basis, Harvard has a $32, $34 billion endowment, which with many fewer students than we do. We have
right.
a 5.2 with 68,000 students. So on a per-student basis, we're not at that level. But it ultimately helps us from a budget standpoint. Roughly, the endowment distributions we get are less than 3% of our total budget, but it does help us from a scholarship standpoint.
It was a big deal when Ohio State started that, but now are we looking at maybe upping the ante in the future?
So our endowment value has actually tripled over the last decade,
right.
which is a combination of fundraising as well as some of the innovative initiatives we've had, like the energy partnership, the parking initiative, things of that nature. So we're still focused on that, still driving towards that. But ultimately, again, it's only 3% of the budget. At some point, we'd like to get it to be a larger piece. But with a $7 billion operating budget, it's about $200 million a year we get from that.
Michael Papadakis, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Michael Papadakis is OSU Interim Senior Vice President, Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at Ohio State, and Stephanie Niles, Vice President for Enrollment and Communications at Ohio Wesleyan University in Delaware County. Thanks for joining us, Stephanie.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Shamina Merchant, OSU Student Government President, thanks for joining us as well.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Moving on, we're going to be hearing from the president of Oglethorpe University in Georgia about how they are managing things differently with price matching of flagship universities in a student's home state. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the cost of college today, how tuition is calculated, and how some colleges and universities are tweaking their rates to better compete in the marketplace. Atlanta-based Oglethorpe University recently announced a price-matching program in which qualified students pay the same amount as the flagship public universities in their home states. Joining us by phone is co-founder of Edmit, a startup that calculates personalized tuition estimates for students, Sabrina Manville. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be here.
And also by phone, Oglethorpe University President Lawrence Shaw. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning.
Dr. Shaw, how did Oglethorpe come to the decision to price match?
So we are very focused on access. Right now we have 40% of our students are Pell eligible. About half of our students are non-majority. So we've been very successful, but we continue to be focused on access, and we know how concerned families are with the cost and value of education. And we were looking for something that would really sort of clear up the misconception that a small private college education with all the benefits that it brings was not affordable. And so this idea sort of first popped up with, you know, could we do this in our home state, the University of Georgia? And then we thought, well, if we're going to do it for Georgia, would we do it for some of our surrounding states? And then the conversation just sort of bloomed. It said, well, let's do a little research across the country and see what would it take to match the home state tuition for this is a merit scholarship program for our sort of top students from all 50 states. So it sort of evolved over the course of a week, and then we went for it.
What has the response been?
It's been pretty remarkable. I think one of the things that families do struggle with is as they're applying for college, and they're applying now for next fall.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of to know ahead of time what is it going to cost a family. And we have very generous financial aid policies. We do over $22 million in aid already. But it's a process, and they have to fill out a FAFSA, and there's calculations, and it's not easy. And so one thing that I think has caught people's attention is if you're from Ohio, you know that you can come to Oglethorpe. The most it will cost you in tuition and fees is what it costs you at Ohio State. That's, you know, about $10,007 or something in that range. And if you come from Louisiana, you know, so there's no guesswork here.
But you are trying to attract high-achieving students. There is a GPA associated with this, right?
There's a GPA and a SAT or ACT score, correct.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be about 15 or 20% of our class
will be using
we'll be eligible for for Flagship 50.
Sabrina Manville, it's not a surprise to know that someone like you exists out there, because if there's one thing I've heard many times over the past 45 minutes or so, is it's complicated and it depends. How do you help students when it comes to choosing which college to attend in terms of price?
Yes, thanks, Sam. So absolutely, as we've heard from basically everyone on this call so far, the pricing that universities have is complicated, and it's often very hard for students and families to understand how much it's going to cost them to go to a particular school because of the discounting that happens and these different arrangements that universities are putting together to attract different students. So our software calculates tuition estimates that are personalized to the student. We use a lot of different sources of data, including data from colleges as well as data from actual students about what financial award packages they received in the past from a given school.
And how does somebody know if they're getting a fair shake? How do I ever know if I've got the same GPA as the next person, I have the same SAT scores, I was in the right clubs, blah, 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 but maybe I'm not getting as much of a reduction in tuition? How, do you ever know that, if you're getting a fair shake?
Well, that's exactly what our estimate, which that's the name of our estimated cost, that's exactly what we're trying to show families. And the reality is that colleges have, are doing a little bit of mind reading, as Rick, I believe, alluded to in the beginning. They're trying to enroll students and to figure out what is it going to take you to get you to say yes. And the reality is that sometimes they get it wrong, either because they think a family situation financially is better than it truly is, or because they just don't realize what options another student is considering. And so what we're hearing from families is that just because they could pay something doesn't mean they're necessarily willing to, because they're considering options, across the spectrum and other institutions that are probably doing a fair amount of discounting as well.
Dr. Shaw, a lot of people that go to, say, an Ohio State, that's all they ever wanted to do is go to Ohio State. That's where they're going to go. It's the only school they look at. I would imagine students that go to a place like Oglethorpe or any kind of nonprofit, private nonprofit, look at a lot of different institutions. So you're competing with a lot of different kinds of places.
Yeah, absolutely. We compete with other small privates. There's a large number of terrific small privates in Ohio. I know many of them well. There's a number in the South as well. But we also, our students often look, to our state public, sometimes the flagships, sometimes not the flagships. You're right that sometimes they grow up wanting to go to University of Georgia because they've been watching University of Georgia football games or Ohio State football games. So one of the things you need to do is to make sure that you communicate to these students both that it is affordable and what the value is. That you're going to be in small classes. We have terrific outcomes for our students. We're in a big city, so many of our students have the opportunities to intern and then follow up and work in Atlanta, one of the country's fastest growing cities. This is in part designed to have that student who, might be only looking at their state flagship to look at a private. And it's also important to know that this is the case in Georgia, and I think this is the case in Ohio, that there's a whole lot of students who could be successful at Ohio State who don't have the opportunity to go there. So they may have grown up with this dream of going there, and done really well in school and done well on their board scores and get rejected.
To the main campus, there's always the regional campuses, which take everyone. But yeah,
exactly. And that's the same in Georgia. And then, and there's a reason that you have flagship schools and you have other schools, and there's different kinds of opportunities at different schools.
Sabrina Manville, how much is cost figuring in the decision in 2018?
Very much. What we hear from families all the time is that
they are not able to afford that sticker price that most colleges have today, you know, the $60,000 and $70,000 sticker price. And so they're looking for schools that can offer a bigger discount. And a lot of families might not be eligible for need-based financial aid on the federal level, but still not have the savings to support and the income to support that price tag. And so that's where initiatives like Oglethorpe's, I think, are kind of changing the conversation around affordability. The studies show that about 40% of students who decide not to go to their top choice college are doing so for reasons related to cost. And so I think what we also care about, though, is not just what's the cheapest school, but what is the school that's going to provide the best outcomes and value for your money. As Dr. Shaw was alluding to, that's something that Edmit also provides is data on earnings and debt repayment and outcomes of students, because this is truly an investment, and college is one of the best investments you can make in America today, in terms of, you know, the professional opportunities that it brings you. However, not all investments in college are created equal, and that's what we're trying to help families understand.
Right. I wanted to go to a school with a school of journalism. That was really important to me, and it kind of eliminated a lot of options right off the bat. Not all students know exactly what they want to do when they're freshmen in college, though. How does the issue of debt figure in? Are people being more conservative now, Sabrina?
Yeah, we hear that from families all the time as well. You know, I think a lot of the conversation about student debt includes kind of graduate debt as well as undergraduate, and there seem to be more severe issues with graduate debt than undergraduate, but it is still a concern for families who, you know, might have kind of a benchmark in their mind for how much debt they're willing to have their student take on as a result of going to college. And so for them, they might say, here's my threshold, $25,000 in debt. I don't want to go over that. And, you know, then they have to kind of work backwards to find a school where the pricing matches.
Dr. Shaw, are you finding that at Oglethorpe that a lot of students are they talking to your financial aid people about what they can afford, not just per semester, but going forward with debt?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think all families, when they're trying to make this decision, you know, it's a combination of cost and value. It is not just cost. You know, we were pleased to be named the FISC Guide of Colleges as one of the 20 best buy colleges in the country, 10 publics and 10 privates, and that rating is a cost and value consideration. It's not just what's the cheapest, but what are the best schools you could go to at a reasonable cost.
Meaning what your graduation rates are, what your employment rates, outcomes are, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that is a big issue. I have talked to families out of coming here because of debt, and say, why don't you spend your first 2 years at a community college, mm-hmm. Given your circumstances. Our debt level is one of the lowest in the state. It's in the top 10% in a good way in the country. Our students on average graduate with less than $25,000 in debt, and we think that's not an unreasonable investment to make in your college education, but you do read these stories, and I really do think they're sort of one-off stories that often end up in the press of some mm-hmm. student that decides to go to a college and graduate with $250,000 of undergraduate debt. And, you know, I suspect there are such people. That would be a really silly decision.
Yeah.
One trend we have seen, though, sorry to jump sure. in, is that parents are actually taking on more debt, and that's debt that's harder to track as student debt, but okay. it's there, and there's evidence to suggest that a lot of the kind of increase in tuition has not necessarily led to the sharpest increases in quote-unquote student debt, but that parents are taking on that burden, which pushes out retirement, you know, and has other implications for the economy. So that's a trend that we've seen at Edmit.
Sabrina Manville, co-founder of Edmit, a startup that calculates personalized tuition estimates for students. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anne.
And also Lawrence Shaw, president of Oglethorpe University. It is price matching with flagship universities in students' home states. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate it.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.